Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a double A cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. And they've even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit right. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15. We are special breakfast people here at Pantsuit Politics, but not just when Beth and I are on the road. The truth is, I want something warm from the oven every Saturday morning and Sunday morning. It's just the truth. It makes it feel special, makes it feel exciting. I don't want to work at it. So the first time I ever saw Wild Grain, which is bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisanal pastries, I was obsessed. You guys, I've been a member for over a year. It's amazing. It's so easy. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less, no thawing required. You can fully customize your Wild Grain box. You can choose any combination of breads, pastas, pastries. You can even build a box of only breads, only pastas, or only pastries if you'd like. And for a limited time, you can get $30 off the first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit to start your subscription. Sometimes I make one single croissant just for me because I want to feel special and they're so good. You heard me. Free croissants in every box. And $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit. That's wildgrain.com/pantsuit. Or you can use promo code pantsuit at checkout. The level of testing and contact tracing and isolation that we would need to not only start to open up now, but to prevent a second worse wave in the fall, we cannot get there without the federal government. This is Sarah.
And Beth.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics,
the home of grace-filled political conversations. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Pantsuit Politics. We recognize that everyone's habits have changed, and perhaps your listening time has changed. And for those of you who are still here with us, sticking with us, finding the in-between spaces to listen, we are so grateful and we're so encouraged by your messages. We also want to thank everyone who shared a message for Friday's episode. Your stories impacted so many people. We got a wonderful update that the listener who talked about foster children in St. Louis was able to connect with a church there who wants to support her agency's efforts. And that is one of many good things that are coming from the fact that you all reached out and shared your story. So thank you so much.
And thank you for all the wonderful feedback we got from everybody who listened to that episode and shared it on social media and encouraged others to listen as well.
So here's the agenda today. We're going to walk through a little bit of news. Then we are going to be joined by Trey Grayson, who is a former Secretary of State in Kentucky. He has worked at the Harvard Institute for Policy, and he's going to just walk us through a lot about upcoming elections given COVID-19, where policy and the business community are intersecting. And so it's a great conversation that we're excited to share with you. We'll end, as always, with what's on our minds outside of politics. And we want to just begin by reminding you, please and thank you, to complete your census if you haven't already done it.
It's so easy. It doesn't take very long. And Chloe
wrote in to really make it real about how important that is. Her current work is coordinating a regional census hub in Michigan, the only state to lose population in the previous census, and in a community-based, community-driven effort to get people to fill them out. She says the goal of this work is to make sure that the hardest-to-count populations, often people of color, low-income families, immigrants, and people experiencing homelessness, are not only counted but given voice and leadership in this effort. I'm also hoping this work is the transition I need to move into politics. I've always wanted to bring a public health perspective into our political system, and hopefully this work is opening the door in that way. We have some great community partners and grantees working on this effort. I'm so proud of what we're doing as a region and as a state. I'm hoping you can continue promoting the census on your show and encourage your listeners to reach out to underserved populations to make sure they are counted. Now more than ever, census responses are so important. School lunches, Medicare, Medicaid, housing assistance, funding for health centers, and community emergency preparedness all depend on our census counts for their funding. This is also a political voice in Washington, D.C., and filling out the census is a way to make sure we have strong representation for our communities.
So get those census forms filled out. If you have any questions, we'll do our best to help you navigate it. The frequently asked questions section on census.gov is really helpful. So if you are struggling, go there. It will probably answer your question, but take a few minutes, do your duty.
One thing we wanted to talk about is not necessarily breaking news, but increasing coverage of the food supply and food insecurity situation in America, and how if you're reading stories about both of these, you're going to want to scream into the void, because what we have is tens of millions of pounds of American-grown produce rotting in the fields. We have milk being poured out, food being left to rot on the supply side. At the same time, we see lines and lines and lines outside food banks. We have food banks closing. This disjointed situation in which we have surplus food rotting and people going hungry. And it's incredibly frustrating and it's incredibly complicated, but we definitely wanted to give it a moment on the show to talk about and raise awareness about.
Part of this is failure at the Agriculture Department to move as quickly as other federal agencies in responding to COVID-19. You know, this is another example of where government can't fix everything, but there are moments when government coordination is one of the only ways to match supply and demand. And that's how Tom Vilsack put it. He was the agriculture secretary during the Obama administration. He told Politico, "It's not that we have a lack of food. It's that the food is in one place and the demand is somewhere else, and they haven't been able to connect the dots. You've got to galvanize people." To add on to this problem, many meat processing plants across the country have been hit hard by coronavirus, and people following those guidelines to stay at home if you're sick is causing some of these plants to shut down. 2 million chickens are set to be euthanized in Delaware and Maryland because of a lack of employees in the processing plants this weekend. So we have millions of animals at risk for being killed and not eaten because of a lack of plant workers, which just brings all kinds of ethical questions to mind. I think this, again, is an example of the acceleration of some existing issues brought on by COVID-19, but it has devastating effects and is something that we really need to keep thinking and talking about and bringing some problem-solving skills to.
You know, this for me is illustrating something I'm seeing in lots of different places. I think you're also seeing this with the entire COVID response coming from the federal government, or lack of a COVID response. You know, as I reported on the show on Friday, I got a COVID test in Paducah because our governor was asking people in my area to come get tested whether or not they were exhibiting symptoms or were frontline workers, because we had the capacity. And I got messages, "I don't understand why you have testing in Kentucky and we're struggling in New Jersey and we have all these outbreaks." And I said, it's because of a lack of a federal response. And, you know, we have conflicting guidance from federal officials. It's a really confused approach as states begin to ease restrictions. We don't have sufficient capacity. You know, we don't have the resources for states to be able to put in place the contact tracing that they need to do, because it's expensive. You have to pay people. That's part of the problem with testing. And because the federal government can print money in a way that states can't, they can't step up and fill that void. And what's frustrating to me is what it feels like is the absence of a government response is being used to justify the argument that government is bad. See, government is incapable. We should never allow government to help solve a problem. We don't ever need federal government or federal the presence of federal government is making everything worse. No, it's the absence of federal government. It's the absence of exactly what he's talking about in the agricultural department, that there sometimes you need the federal government to step in for a lot of reasons and fill the void, to connect the dots, to coordinate the response so that you don't have a flood of testing in some area and absence of testing in others, so that you don't have meat processing problems where we're dumping food and hungry people in other parts of the country. You know, until we all decide to shut our borders down and act independently, the United States of America are in this together. And the complete and total absence of the federal government, to me, you know, the impact of that is just compounding by the day. And you see it play out in lots and lots of different areas. You know, I think this is true. We talk about this with Trey Grayson in the second section of the show with the CARES Act. You know, I think you see people, oh, we'll see, look, it's just corporation at the highest order. The federal government started passing out money. And see, every time the federal government comes in, it's bad and it's corrupt and things go wrong. No, it's not that there was too much government. It's that there wasn't enough. There was no transparency. There was no regulation, partly by design of the Trump administration. And it's just so frustrating to me that this narrative keeps building and building and building.
You know, I don't have all the answers here for myself, even in terms of how I feel about everything that's happening. Here is how I'm thinking about it right now. I am more leaning toward the idea as we go through this crisis that government is neither good nor bad. It is just a tool that needs to show up sometimes and needs to stay out of the way other times. And when it shows up, needs to be used correctly. And we are really bad in this country at looking at things as neutral and just thinking about when should they show up. I see the food supply chain as an example of both the absence and the presence of government as problematic. Because it is true that the absence of government serving a coordinating function right now is devastating. It is also true that we have regulations about exactly what food may be donated, in what size packages, how it can be transported, that is preventing people from getting food to the places that need it most. And the government apparatus is so unwieldy that it can be difficult to change those regulations quickly enough to meet the demands of an emergency. Those aren't foolish regulations that were put in for no reason, right? We have them to protect us. And also sometimes protecting us from one thing looks really silly when there's a much bigger thing to be protected from. My thinking right now is forming around the idea that probably the federal government's resources are allocated in such a thin way. I've been thinking about my old boss who always talked about how sometimes we would use our marketing dollars as sort of a peanut butter spread, that we would just spread it out so thinly among so many different causes that we really don't make much of a difference anywhere. And that's how I'm feeling about the federal government right now, that we have this peanut butter spread. Even with the CARES Act, we're just trying to do so many things at one time that we're not able to do any of them very well. And there are some things that are just uniquely the province of the federal government. And many of those things have been hamstrung by people like me who believe we should restrict federal power because we don't want to pay for something that's not an urgent need. But the truth is, if we had properly been funding the CDC all along, if we had been thinking about the federal emergency stockpile as something worthy of massive infusions of money, even as we did not need it, especially when we did not need it, we would be much better positioned right now. And so as I look at the whole picture, I have both agreement and disagreement with you, I think, on government. But I just really want to take a more neutral view and think, like, what places do we need this tool and how can we deploy this tool effectively? Every policy has trade-offs. Every policy has a downside. Every policy has the potential for and the actuality of some corruption associated with it. And that's true whether the impact is coming from government or culture or the private sector entirely or the nonprofit sector. That we're human beings, so there's always going to be a downside. How do we maximize the upside and minimize the downside when we think about bringing in federal solutions?
I just think we're getting to a really dangerous place where there's zero trust that there ever can be a federal solution. And I think that's a really scary place to be in. You know, what is the alternative to no federal presence? Because I feel like we're getting really close to that, like to the idea that any government at all at the federal level is to be distrusted, is to be fought against, is to be protested, is a threat to liberty, is a threat to your constitutional rights. And, you know, it's just starting to kind of concern me. And I mean, it's always been out there, but it seems that, you know, there's never evidence that the federal government can help. Like you can't, that's not even becoming a valid, much less a moderate position, that sometimes the government is needed.
I feel like that's a minority position that's getting a lot of attention right now because it's the interesting storyline. Do you think I'm wrong about that?
I mean, I just feel like I hear it. It's not just that I'm reading about it in news stories about the protest. I hear it from people. I hear it, this undercurrent. And look, the problem is that there is lots of evidence to say, especially in recent American history, that the presence of the federal government often makes things worse. You know, I see the corruption already in the Payment Protection Program. I was alive during Hurricane Katrina. I've read a lot about the torture memo and our response to 9/11, much less the fact that we couldn't prevent 9/11. I mean, like, I could list and list and list all the good evidence. You don't need to be a conspiracy theorist to say the federal government has often made huge mistakes and made things worse. And that, you know, it's just like it's feeding itself. So because that's true, and then you have enough to really undercut any federal response, then you add to the list of times when the federal response was inadequate or corrupt or problematic. And so that feeds on itself. And it just feels like this feedback loop we can't get out of. And I don't know. But I can list all those things, too. And yet, what's the alternative? Because it seems like we're looking at the alternative now, which is the federal government doesn't do anything. And so far, we have 55,000 Americans dead and an economy that's been decimated. And it just feels like I don't know, especially until November, if we continue under the Trump administration, how we break that cycle and say, beyond just the local and state level, where I think you are seeing trust build, but they can only go so far. They can't print money. They can't pay an army of contact tracers and increased amounts of PPE and the supplies we need for testing to get testing to where we need to open up our economy while in the face of decimated budgets when they can't print money. And it just feels like we're at a standstill where they've done what they can do. And we have a federal government, particularly an executive branch, unwilling to step in to fill the hole, and an American populace that says, see, this is what we said, we told you was going to happen. And I feel like I don't know how we break out of that. I feel powerless.
I almost wish that the American populace were consistent enough to say, see, that's what happened. What I see happening in sort of my Facebook sphere, for example, is just using everything as an opportunity to sort people based on where they are on the president. Mm-hmm. You know, this whole mm-hmm. debacle with the disinfectant and the sunlight just eclipsed my Facebook feed over the weekend. And it was memes about how dumb the president is and passionate defenses of the president's words. And I looked at that. I don't remember what this is called, but have you ever been on that amusement park ride or like a county fair ride where you get into a compartment and it's like you and two or three people in that compartment? And the purpose of the ride is to simultaneously spin your compartment and spin the whole thing that is connected by the spokes.
And you get shoved up against the wall?
Yes. And so it's like a scrambler, except you're scrambling on two different levels at once. And it feels like the whole goal is just to see how long you can stand this before you get so dizzy that you like lose your funnel cake and icy. Anyway, that is how I feel right now in the social media dialogue about the president. I want off this ride because it makes me so dizzy to fight over the president's words, which are truly the least relevant thing to anything we could be talking about right now. I mean, who cares what he said at that press conference compared to the entire list of issues that people really need to be thinking about right now? Not that it doesn't matter. I get that when the governor of Maryland says, we're getting lit up with calls about whether it's safe for people to drink Lysol, we got a problem. I mean, I'm not trying to minimize the bully pulpit, but in a way, I'm just ready to move on from that argument. I would rather be fighting about what's the proper role of the federal government than what President Trump just said. I don't know. Overall, to me, I have concerns about what a federal response would look like. It makes me nervous to talk about federal contact tracing. I'll say it out loud. At the same time, I don't think the federal government ought to be competing with states for those supplies if it's going to leave the states on their own. We just have no consensus in this country around what we expect people to do. And no aptitude, it seems, for problem solving and seeing that one answer is not going to do it. We need a federal approach to testing as well as coordinated state measures, right? As well as local measures. We need federal guidance on being healthy at work, as well as state and local guidance and regional guidance. When I read all these articles about what's going to happen with the economy, they are written so passively as though the economy is just this mystical thing out there. And hopefully it'll be kind to us at the end of all this. No, the economy is like, what are you doing with your dollars right now? In addition to everything that else that's going on, like we just need to all step up and recognize there's a lane for everybody else to step up to. And that includes the federal government.
What it feels like to me is, with regards to the reopening, that everyone is so anxious to step forward into, we have reached the limits of what state and local leaders can do to get us to that point. Like, the level of testing and contact tracing and isolation that we would need to not only start to open up now, but to prevent a second worse wave in the fall, we cannot get there without the federal government. I think we're seeing that. That's where we are right now. It feels like we're stuck. Testing is not ramping up. Testing is not changing on a nationwide level. We're stuck. And I don't see how even these regional alliances can get us there. Like, we need the resources, particularly the financial resources of the federal government. And it's just, you know, it's frustrating. And I think that conversation about the disinfectant is the same thing, which is, it's a different version of the same conversation, which is, you can't trust the government, you can only trust him, or you can't trust the government because he is the government. I got a lot of messages that said, are you really interested in a vaccine? I would never trust a vaccine from the Trump administration. Or I would never trust a vaccine that comes from Bill Gates. Like, it's all this really intense foundation of distrust that I can't necessarily say, oh, you should never be distrustful. You have nothing to base that on. I get it. But I'm not sure how we deal with a global pandemic that truly connects us all on such a thick foundation of distrust.
Well, before we move on to talking with Trey Grayson about some of the policy things that are happening, I want to take just a second to update you on a few COVID-19 developments. If you are not engaged in the news outside of Pantsuit Politics, we want you to be sure to know that the World Health Organization is now telling us there is no good evidence that contracting COVID-19 means that you will be immune from getting it again. We just don't know yet. But the point of this is that governments talking about some kind of immunity passport are out ahead of the science. The science is not there yet. There is also reporting about a serious risk of blood clots to COVID-19 patients, even people who are relatively young and healthy. And so if you are continuing to have discussions with people who don't take this seriously, it is not just that you are going to get something like a flu. Again, just a reminder that Blood clots are so scary. I lost a family member way too young because of a blood clot during an otherwise routine procedure. So this is not something to take lightly. And there seems to be the Washington Post describes it as a mysterious risk associated with blood clots and COVID-19. And then finally, the CDC has added to fever, cough, and shortness of breath, new symptoms of chills, repeated shaking with chills, muscle pain, headache, sore throat, and new loss of taste or smell. Some of those we've known about for a while, but they are officially part of the CDC list at this point.
And as always, we want to share your compliments to your local and state leaders. We heard from Jennifer complimenting her governor, Kate Brown of Oregon. She says, while I have not found Kate Brown to be as inspiring or charismatic as Kentucky's governor, she did a very good thing this week. She sent 140 ventilators to New York. I also love that response from my friends on Facebook has been universally positive.
I have always liked Kate Brown, and I think she's plenty inspiring and charismatic.
I also don't think that's a word people use for Andy Beshear very often, but I appreciate it.
It's so funny to hear that about Governor Beshear, too, but he's doing a great job. Okay. We also heard from Meredith about a few local leaders in Alabama, including Birmingham's mayor, Randall Woodfin, who has been calm and competent in getting things done. He even made a quarantine playlist on Spotify. Well done, Mayor Woodfin. Her principal, Melissa Hatter, is leading our school so well. I loved this compliment because, oh my goodness, having a good principal right now matters. Mm-hmm. Principal Hatter is sending daily announcement videos to students to keep them connected to our school. She's contacted each faculty member personally to check in, take safety guidelines very seriously. Her guidance in distance learning is less is more and don't overwhelm the parents, yet she is still valuing the contributions of special teachers like music. And Meredith is so grateful for that. And her pastor, Buddy Gray, canceled services at church the first week they had confirmed cases in Alabama, explained to people how we are loving our neighbors by staying home. And this is at a large suburban Southern Baptist church where the majority of members at that point were not likely to take it seriously. And Meredith is really grateful for Pastor Gray's wise leadership.
We also heard from Rachel complimenting Mayor Lori Lightfoot of Chicago. She says that she has been doing a really good balancing act between hardline leadership and humor. There's been some really funny memes, and the mayor has said she enjoys them and she's glad that they're making people laugh. She made a really great video asking people to stay home and save lives. And she's been working in really good partnership with Governor Pritzker and has worked to turn McCormick Place into a makeshift hospital so Chicago is ready if the outbreak worsens.
Thank you all for continuing to share inspiring examples of leadership during this crisis. Next up, we're going to be talking with Trey Grayson. Trey served as a two-term Secretary of State for the Commonwealth of Kentucky, where he was recognized as a national leader in government innovation and election modernization. He served as chair of the Republican Association of Secretaries of State and as president of the National Association of Secretaries of State. Trey has also served as director of the Harvard Institute of Politics, as well as on the Bipartisan Presidential Commission on Election Administration. And I can tell you that Trey is someone who's been very professionally and personally gracious to me, and we are excited to share some of his thinking with all of you. If you're looking for a very quick salon quality, but not salon priced manicure, Olive & June has you covered. We've talked about Olive & June's Mani system before. It has everything that you need for a professional manicure in one box. Salon grade tools, your choice of six polishes. Those polishes are going to last you for 7 days or more. The cost breaks down to about $2 a manicure. Olive & June also has press-ons if you want. What I love, though, is that Olive & June each season is coming out with new colors, and I just got a set of spring and summer colors in quick dry polish. And they say this dries in about a minute. It seemed dry to me in about 30 seconds. It was not kidding about being quick dry. I also love the light colors in this set. There is a huge range. My favorite one is called Kitten. It's like a pinkish gray. The quick dry polish gives you full coverage in one or two coats. It lasts for more than 5 days, and it is offered in more than 40 cruelty-free and vegan polishes. Olive & June just understands what's happening in our lives, that we need to move quickly, but we want to look great and feel great and have fun in the process. Visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first mani system.
Just finished A Court of Thorns and Roses and craving another fantasy world to devour?
Dipsy's got you. Dive into spicy enemies to lovers' tales or embark on an epic romance between immortal fae and sworn foes. They've got fantasy romance stories perfect for your morning walk, late night, or long bath. Dipsy is an app full of short, spicy audio stories. They bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. Discover stories about second chance romances, adventurous vacation flings, and hot and heavy hookups. And there's a growing library of fantasy series with werewolves, Greek gods and goddesses, Regency era historical fiction, and fairy smut to explore the bounds of your pleasure. New content is released every week, so in between listening to your favorite stories again and again, you can always find something new to explore. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. dipsystories.com/pantsuit. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Can I get something off my chest? Every day I feel a little pang of sadness because I think about Griffin going away to college. Y'all, he's a freshman in high school. This is not healthy or normal. This is why I have it on my list of things to talk to my therapist about. We all carry around these things, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us. Therapy is a safe space to get these things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. You gotta get it off your chest. And you can get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/pantsuit.
Thanks for being with us today, Trey. I wanted to start by asking you about your experience as Kentucky's Secretary of State. We've had a lot of publicity around Kentucky's Secretary of State and our elections here lately. But on a broader scale, what should we be thinking about in terms of election security, specifically as it relates to November?
So first, I think there's just got to be a recognition that we're not going to have a normal election in November. We're not going to be out of this pandemic. Hopefully we'll be in a much better spot in November than we are today, but it's not going to be like it was in November of 2018 or 2019. So whether you're an election administrator, a policymaker, or a voter, or anybody else involved in the elections process, you just have to approach it with that. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that we have to work right now on November. It's almost too late to be able to implement changes for November in an ideal world. Now, we don't live in an ideal world, and a lot of states are having to adapt, but it's not too early to make decisions about November. And we're going to have to make assumptions. And I start with that first assumption. It's not going to be a normal election. We're going to have more social distancing. We're going to have at-risk populations whose considerations, whether they're poll workers or voters, we're going to have to deal with. So we're going to have to make assumptions today that guide our decisions down the road, just like businesses are making decisions where they're canceling things or pushing things off. We're going to have to make decisions today on elections. And so I think that's a good framework to approach election administration or voting or just our elections in general for November of 2020. We've seen some examples of states that, you know, are caught in the middle of the pandemic and they weren't ready. Now, that's not to fault of their own. It's not something you gamed out. And so the election calendar caught Wisconsin and caught Ohio and a few other states in a really bad spot. They could have handled it better, but they were in a tough spot even if they had all been on the same page and had, you know, were trying to solve the problem. Other states like Kentucky were able to push their primary back a couple of months, but we still, you know, and our Secretary of State, our governor, our state board are doing a great job, but we have about 2 months to plan this election, a little bit less than 2 months. It's a primary, so it'll be lower turnout. States that are looking November can look at the states like Kentucky that delayed their elections to June for some guidance on how things might go. And I'll just stop there because I could go on. There's a lot we could talk about the elections, and I want to be guided by your questions.
Well, I do think as we're, you know, making assumptions, looking to the guidance of some primary states as we move into the fall, I wonder, based on your experience, how much of that planning needs to include permanent changes that you think would be beneficial moving forward as a country forever? And how many do you think need to be temporary?
Well, so there's a couple things that are in tension here. One is we are in the middle of an emergency, and some of the ways that we can adapt how we run our elections can only work in an emergency. And what I mean by that is, in Kentucky, for example, the state is moving to allow vote by mail without an excuse. The way that is happening is through an emergency declaration that can be made when there's a state of emergency, which means that in 2022, let's say, we're out of a state of emergency, Kentucky would have to pass laws to allow more vote by mail. Now, it's probably really expedient to focus on using those power of those emergencies to get things done today. And it's also easier to get to political consensus on some things. You know, for example, vote by mail is one where there are different views on it, sometimes ideological, sometimes partisan. But if you agree to only make that decision in the context of the pandemic, you can get to consensus more easily. The downside of that is it costs the secure ballot box, for example, that you put in the courthouse to allow voters to drop off their ballots on election day, costs the same amount of money, whether you're using it, you know, only in 2020 or whether you're using it for many years down the road. The way you train might be different if you know you're doing this going forward. So we might make some, and the different kinds of investments you might make with other equipment and other procedures, you might be able to be more cost effective. But it may be that given the emergency situation, that the best scenario for policymakers, especially if there's a disagreement on the going forward, is to just get to consensus as quickly as you can so you can make sure that the primaries, those that are left, and the generals are successful. As a country, we are moving to more early voting, meaning not on election day, or vote by mail. The different terms use different things, mean different things. So there's a trend in that direction, but there are differences between, you know, in-person early voting, which I personally really like, and no excuse vote by mail, which I'm less a fan of, although I recognize that we absolutely need it this year. And so you're just going to have find that balance. And I know that administrators and policymakers are struggling with that.
Can you give us a window into why you prefer early in-person voting to vote by mail?
So the reason why I prefer no excuse early voting, which means you can vote in advance of election day, but in person without an excuse versus no excuse vote by mail, is basically colored by my experience in Kentucky politics, where we do have in our, especially in our rural areas, some vote buying that takes place. And I think that election security is much easier on an election day or an election day like experience, which you can adapt to early voting, where you have poll workers in person, people are checking in, they're, you know, meeting some type of identification requirement. I don't want to get into strict IDs. Well, we can in a later conversation, but not for the reason why I prefer one over the other has nothing to do with the type of ID law. But it's that experience of in person where when it's vote by mail, it's really easy to walk down the nursing home hallways and have people fill it out. And we've seen that in Kentucky, not in big races at presidential level or Senate level or congressional level. We see it in county office. And Beth, you have family experience. I'm not saying with vote fraud or vote buying like that, but you have family members involved in local politics. And Kentucky has a lot of small governments. Those small governments are influential in their communities, and they usually mean some jobs, which makes the stakes a little bit different. So we've seen that. And that's why I like in-person voting as opposed to vote by mail. I just like the security. Now, the downside is it costs more. Vote by mail is, on the whole, is cheaper because you don't have to have those people in person for several days. But I guess that's the price I'm willing to pay in general, in a non-pandemic world, for my policy preference. And the overall goal is we should vote the way we live.
You know, what we've been talking a lot about is what a pandemic world does is accelerates change and really clarifies problems. And it seems to me that this is probably true in the context of our elections as well, that anything we're talking about or any problems we're trying to address as far as voter empowerment or accessibility or voter fraud, voter reform, like this is, it was all true before COVID-19. COVID-19 is just accelerating and intensifying these issues.
I think that's exactly right. We're seeing it in the business world with the move, with the challenges with retail, and we're absolutely seeing it in voting. And what's interesting is we've seen, I don't know if you term the term, disasters or big cataclysmic events cause voting laws to change over time. Our first absentee ballots came in the Civil War when a lot of the voters that President Lincoln needed to help him get reelected were out on the battlefield, not at home. Mm. So absentee balloting was created. The World War One, where we saw the expansion of the franchise to women, and a lot of that was we saw women taking on much bigger roles, and it became even more ridiculous to deny them the right to vote. And similar with expansion of the vote to youth during the Vietnam era, where we were sending 18-year-olds off to fight and die for their country, and they weren't allowed to vote on those decisions. To elect the lawmakers to make who were making those decisions. And probably even though there was a little bit of a delay, African-Americans fighting in World War II and then ultimately into Korea, similar thing coming into the Civil Rights Act. Like, how can we not have them the right, give them the right to vote in certain parts of this country when they're fighting and dying to defend everybody else's right to vote? So, yeah, I think this is a real clarifying moment. We're not going to go back to the way we did elections prior to this. Absolutely.
I want to go back to the first thing you said, which is you need to start now for November and it's almost too late. I think I have a lot of sympathy for that, probably because I spent so many years working with lawyers. But I wonder for the person out there who's listening, thinking, why is it so damn hard? Like, I feel like we have that sense about everything right now. This is America. Right. Why can't we figure it out quickly? So can you help us understand why it is so damn hard?
Sure. So if you just look at vote by mail. And those who, most everybody who's listening has probably had to vote by mail at some point in their lives. Maybe they went away to college or on vacation or something like that. So when you vote by mail, you've got a piece of paper that's your ballot, and that's enclosed in an envelope, which is sealed. And then that sealed envelope is enclosed in a larger envelope. That ballot is somehow returned to the vote counters. And when they count the votes, they determine the eligibility first on the outer envelope. And then once that ballot is deemed to be eligible to be counted, they set that outer ballot aside, and then they set the other ballot into another stack, and then they later count that actual vote. And that way, we keep the anonymity. You know, they don't literally open it right there and say, oh, you know, Trey Grayson's, he's eligible to vote. Yep, this is his ballot. And, oh, look, he voted for Donald Trump. I didn't. So you got a couple of things here. Those are envelopes are unusually sized. You can't just go to Staples and buy those or order them on Amazon. It takes a while to produce those envelopes. You have to print instructions on them. You have to design instructions. You have to train people. So when we're ramping up capacity, we're going to need a lot more envelopes. That's going to require, you know, then states have to think about, do they mail out ballots to everybody? Do they mail out a postcard, which is, I think, is the plan in Kentucky and in a lot of other states, alerting people to this. Kentucky's building an online ballot request system, so they have to do that. You have to hire more people.
You have to hope there are no supply chain issues with all those envelopes.
Yeah, and it's also, okay, how are we going to count the votes? I mean, even if you're Colorado or Arizona or the other Western states that do a lot of this, they're going to have to keep everybody 6 feet apart. You know, so even in those states, there are going to be changes. And so it can take a lot of time to get those supply chains out. We have military and overseas voters. We need to get those ballots in the mail 45, 50 more days in advance because, you know, a November election means you have to get them in the mail, just say 2 months out. You know, it's not quite a month and a half, 2 months out. So now you're back to, you know, September, late September. And, you know, you got to wait for the primary. So it just takes a long time to do all this. And the EAC, the Elections Assistance Commission, not the East Australian Current, from Finding Nemo, but the other EAC, the less famous EAC, a couple weeks ago put together some guidelines, some assistance. That's what the A stands for, assistance. And they basically said you need to start now for November if you're going to do all this just because of all the bumps in the road that it's going to take. So, yeah, that's why it takes so long. Then, by the way, all this costs money. And fortunately, Congress put $400 million in the CARES Act for elections. And then there was some other money. Actually, I think it's more than $400 million. I think that number is wrong, so I apologize. But I'm off the top of my head, I'm having a mental blank. And there was also some money in last year's funding bill for just election security, and states are going to tap that money as well. But that's all one-time money, which goes back to the earlier question about permanence versus temporary nature of some of these changes.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, "I cannot believe how young you look." And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off. There's not much worse than a dry, itchy scalp. Also, when you get your hair colored and then it does not last as long as you and your stylist discussed, it could be that unfiltered, mineral-filled water is the culprit. Hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin, and about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered shower head comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered shower head. Dermatologists recommended this unique 3-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered shower head is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze, and its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered shower head purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a double A cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. And they've even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit right. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Well, it seems like every struggle, everything that is so damn hard, is also an opportunity. What do you hope comes out of this 5 years down the line when we see changes that aren't just linked to the emergency nature of a pandemic?
One is, in states where you see people setting aside partisanship to try to work together, hopefully that'll translate going forward with how we run our elections. I think, too, one of the things we have in state elections is that you hear the term laboratories of democracy. We're going to see a whole lot of movement towards, more vote by mail, more dropping off of ballots and drive-by polling places and things like that. So we're going to get some good ideas and some good data on how this works. I also hope that this is one of the things that's really frustrated me is there's no data that there's a partisan advantage to vote by mail. There's a couple ways of looking at it. I mean, one is, what's the base of the Republican Party right now? Older voters. Who are the people who probably shouldn't go to the polls because of being in high risk categories? Older voters. So if you're a Republican, you really want vote by mail or your folks can't win. Conversely, and this is what I find the irony, is that many Republican leaders, President Trump being the most high profile, are opposed to vote by mail. Many Democratic leaders are pushing it. But one of the challenges with vote by mail is there are more opportunities for your ballot not to count. You mess up that data on the outer envelope. And if you were there on election day, there would have been a poll worker to help you out. Or maybe you left a race blank or voted twice in one race. If you're on election day, the scanner, because most people now vote on paper, will reject the ballot if you've overvoted, that more than one candidate counted or voted for when you're only allowed to vote for the one. Or undervoted, oftentimes you get a little beep and say, hey, did you mean to undervote? Well, when you don't have that assistance there, the poll worker, we know that ballots are going to be rejected on election day. Well, Democrats tend to believe that more of their voters are these infrequent voters who are more likely to struggle outside of that polling place. And so there is this interesting tension where both parties have bought into the stereotype, but the reality is neither is actually correct in their beliefs. And so out of this, I just hope we get past that and just say, let's vote where it's convenient. Let's not, fight about these things. And especially let's not fight when we're wrong about our beliefs on these things. We shouldn't anyway. We should just run a good election and let the candidates, win on the merits. But I've just been really struck by some of the parties pushing these things. And I mean, really making arguments that don't seem valid to me.
Well, let's think more about that intersection of politics and business, because you have experience leading the Chamber of Commerce locally, and in addition to your experience at Harvard. So tell us about what the next iteration of the CARES Act should look like as you assess how it's performed thus far and where it's fallen short.
At our law firm, I work for Frost Brown Todd, which is a big law firm in the middle part of flyover country, for lack of a better term. We're working with a lot of clients on this, and we're following the CARES Act really closely. There are a couple of big questions that the members of Congress have to answer with, I think that we call this 4.0. The tweak last week they're referring is 3.5 as far as the different bills that have been passed. So for 4.0, there are a couple of flashpoints. One is local and state government assistance. Their tax revenues are plummeting at a time when they're having to spend a lot more money on unemployment claims, but also just like revamping their unemployment systems to be able to handle the demand. They're having to, spend more on public health, paying for that PPE. Somebody's paying for that. That costs money. So they're having a lot of stress, and they're also having their tax revenues decline. Unlike the federal government, they cannot print money. They don't have a central banking system. So that's going to, and we've seen this fight. Senator McConnell made the comment about, states going through bankruptcy. Don't look to the federal government for a bailout for your prior profligate ways. But the reality is that whether a state was profligate or not, or had a big rainy day fund or not, nobody had a rainy day fund outside of, I think, Alaska. And they're very unique to sustain the state's finances. And so that's one area. The second is, this looks like it's going to be a longer financial hit than probably was assumed a few months ago. Or I guess we weren't in this a few months ago, a few weeks ago, a month ago when CARES Act was first passed.
It just felt like a decade ago. It's totally cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember all the jokes in March ended. It felt like it was, a forever month. And now April's nearly the end and it's the same thing. But so these ideas, the loans, the PPP loans, quickly ran out of money. They put a bunch of money in last week. They're going to run out of it again this week. And so trying to maintain those payrolls, can we keep doing that? Should we keep doing that? How do you write those laws in a manner that benefits the small businesses, which need help, also are political beneficiaries, but balancing the fact that, there's employees who work for the big firms too that don't want to be laid off, that need the money. And so, you can complain about Ruth Chris getting all that money, but they have a lot of employees. And when you're the employee of Ruth Chris and you're the employee of the small restaurant, from an employee standpoint, you're the same thing. And so we have to wrestle with that. There's a strong argument to be made for some more elections funding. That's another area to look at. And then I think, and there was a little bit of help in this in 3.5, but the rural hospitals and other hospitals, they've not been allowed to do their elective procedures. And that's where they make the money to pay for a lot of the other things. It's kind of like college sports, basketball and football on the men's side, make all the money and then allow you to have a fully robust intercollegiate program. Same thing with hospitals, the heart surgeries and other, you know, orthopedic surgeries. Those are some things where they use that money to pay for the things that don't pay for that don't, you know, where they can't cover the costs or there's no real margin. So those are a couple of the big areas, I think, from a legislative standpoint. You start to hear conversations about liability concerns with people who are pivoting to PPE manufacturing. Should we encourage more of that? But then the flip side again is, what if you're the person who buys the PPE, gives it to your employees or patients, and it doesn't work? Somebody should be responsible for that. So is the government going to assume that responsibility financially as well? And then last and not least is the debt. At some level, you know, this is a lot of money. But if you don't prop up industries and businesses and employees, then that could be the least of your concern. So I think we've kind of wrestled back. But you're going to see more of that, I think, over the next, you know, in the conversations about this next bill that it looks like will start in earnest, you know, I guess in about a week. I think the Senate's coming back and that will be a big topic of conversation.
It seems like one of the issues is just the lack of transparency. If the idea in elections is that we'll gather lots of data and see what works and see what doesn't, and yet we're passing out all this money, particularly with the Paycheck Protection Program, with no transparency as to what the companies are getting. You know, the only reason we know that Shake Shack gave it back is because they told everybody. So, you know, I wonder if that transparency is really hobbling not only the efforts to get the money where it needs to go, but any sort of, like we said, future efforts to make sure what we're learning during this pandemic can follow through into long-term solutions to the problems that were there before the pandemic.
You're absolutely right. I should have said transparency. I'm glad you added it. It's one, there's always tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch. You know, the legislative branch wants more transparency. It's how they hold that executive accountable. That's how we in the public hold the executive accountable. Sometimes transparency slows down the process, but that's a price we are willing to pay to avoid corruption and to help us judge whether the programs are being run effectively. And so, yeah, that'll be another one. There needs to be more transparency. And the irony is, when you're an executive branch and you object to that, usually you get legislative hearings anyway. And in fact, you might get more transparency if you don't put some into the law, put some teeth into the law and set up some advisory committees that way. The Congress, especially when the one party controls at least one chamber of Congress, then as opposed to the administration, you're always going to get some transparency. But we'd like to get it quicker. You know, we'd like to be able to know. I think the Shake Shack one is a good example. They also, you know, they figured out that there was some private equity dollars that were out there and that they could get some good publicity for it, but that's fine. You know, I like when incentives are aligned. You know, they didn't need to take taxpayer dollars. They found a better product and I'm going to go buy more Shake Shack. Fine. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and I can't wait till I can go to Lexington because that's the closest Shake Shack to where I live, but I'll drive an hour for that.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about the business community and especially, you know, when you're working at a place like a chamber of commerce, you have to think about not only your hundreds of employees kind of businesses, but also the guy who has three employees, right? And how those small businesses adapt. I was listening to Governor Beshear yesterday talking about businesses that want to reopen and how they are going to be responsible for acquiring their own PPE. And these are going to be businesses that sometimes have never thought about gloves or masks or anything like that. And it struck me that that is probably both the fair answer that the state should not become a supplier of PPE for every business in Kentucky, and also just an incredibly unfair one if you think about how businesses are able to compete if hospitals aren't able to get everything they need right now and they're used to tapping those supply chains. How is the massage therapist supposed to be in it? So I wonder what, from a policy perspective, we ought to be doing about that, or what? How can businesses in the private sector support each other? Like, how do we solve that problem?
It's a really tough one. I'm actually, for our firm, helping out internally with helping us to figure out. We have 8 states in which we have offices. We've got 13 offices spread over those 8 states. And helping us to figure out how can we reopen? What are those rules and guidelines? So I've been watching the states in our footprint, which are primarily draw a circle around Kentucky and Cincinnati, and you know, those are our states. And you're absolutely right. So you've got it's on them to provide PPE. You know, if you're a restaurant and you're going to reopen, every state that's talked about this has said you get to operate at 50% capacity, so you can spread your tables out so people can have more social distance. If you are, I was on a call this morning with some folks, and there was an event venue, and they said that, you know, they have their first wedding booked in mid-June. They said, we're not sure whether we can have it or not, but we've got it booked. It's 10 people, 10 guests, but then they're going to have like 10 staff members because they're going to have to clean the bathrooms every 15 minutes. Mm. You know, no waiting rooms like the massage therapist you talked about. He or she's not going to be able to have, let's just say she, because it's easier. And she's not going to be able to have people wait inside. They're going to have to wait in their cars and figure out that system. That's going to, she'll have to do more cleaning of the equipment than normal. So she won't be able to have to schedule as many customers. There's a lot of real burdens on them. A restaurant owner I was talking to recently said that they're going to keep a heavy emphasis on takeout because they're going to need that extra takeout revenue to offset the decline of in-service, you know, in-person revenue. Even if they completely filled up, they're going to be at 50%. And they anticipate not filling up completely because people are still, even if you're allowed to go out, people are still going to probably be personally reluctant. We saw this on the front end as if you look at some of the data, people started sheltering in place earlier than the mandates went in. We were already starting to do that. There's no reason to think that when we're allowed to reopen our economies and our restaurants and businesses, that people are going to immediately go back to what they were. They're still going to have that level of reluctance. It's just all of what makes, you know, things like PPE and other small business loan assistance all the more important, because you're not going to be able to get back to normal. The good thing about PPE for smaller businesses, not in the healthcare capacity, is, again, this goes back to a restaurant. I heard they were, you know, this one restaurant was saying, we're going to make fun masks that are kind of on theme with our restaurant. You can make masks at home. My daughter's making them. So that kind of PPE, but things like disinfectants and latex gloves and other things, hopefully those supply chains will be able to ramp up more quickly. You won't have the sophisticated masks that healthcare employers need and the plastic face shields. So maybe some of the PPE for businesses won't be as hard to obtain necessarily, but it's still an added cost to, low margin businesses. And so, are you better off opening in that uncertainty? You're better off staying closed. Can you accumulate that debt and then pay it off, you know, later by staying closed, but, you know, absorb that uncertainty because maybe you accumulate less debt? These are all really hard decisions. Fortunately, trade associations are stepping up to help provide guidance for their individual industries and sectors, and it looks like the states are starting to follow them. Today, we're recording this around noon on Monday, April 27th, and today Governor DeWine in Ohio, who I think has done an amazing job, is going to announce his reopening plan. And I'm really interested to see somebody who's been pretty thoughtful and sober and appears to be really competent, how he approaches reopening compared to some of the other states that where I maybe have had not been as big a fan as how some of those other states have handled this and are now starting to reopen. So I'll be tuning in today at 2 to see DeWine's approach, and I'm sure his approach will impact Governor Beshear and Governor Holcomb in the neighboring states, because they seem to be working pretty much in tandem on a lot of things.
Well, Trey, we really appreciate, I think, your overlap of expertise in, with elections and with the Chamber of Commerce has been a really, really valuable perspective as we look at these long-term problems, short-term emergency solutions, and what that means for all of us moving forward. Beth, what's on your mind outside politics?
Know that I am very, very late to this party, but I finally started watching Schitt's Creek. And it is as delightful as advertised. I'm really enjoying it. It is about what I can handle right now at the end of a long day when we've finally gotten the kids in bed and I'm ready to collapse. I love David so much on that show that I wish he were my neighbor. I just think it's wonderful. It's fun to see the Home Alone mom in a totally different role. I've always loved her because of that movie, and she is fantastic on Schitt's Creek. So, hooray, I'm glad that I saved it for this time of life.
Okay, here's what I'm thinking about. That it is true that I very much value my public school education and public school teachers, and I'm grateful for the education I received. And also, this opportunity is putting in stark relief vast holes in my knowledge, particularly when it comes to science and math. So my kids and I have been doing the Big History Project, which is really cool. It literally starts at the Big Bang and then goes all the way through like modern history and tries to put everything in perspective. And there's just so much about that area of science, of chemistry. And I'm also learning a lot through our book club book, The Big Thirst, about water and all of that that I just didn't know and didn't understand. I think also I'm realizing, because of all the coverage of the economy, corporate America, particularly with regards to debt, how much I don't understand about that part of our world and how it functions. And so, like, all this homeschooling is making me realize that I still have a lot to learn as a student.
I don't think you should feel inadequate about that at all. I mean, you know lots of things, and there's just always more to know. And I think that's lovely. And it's good to, like, return to some of those things, too, because what I'm finding is Jane is doing a lot of things that sound vaguely familiar to me. I'm sure that I studied it at some point. But having all the context that I have now as an adult makes me see it totally differently. And so I think some of it is probably you did learn it at one point. You just didn't learn it in a way that really sinks in and recognize the importance of it the way you do now.
I do really think some of it was I very much internalized the narrative that science and math is not for girls. I mean, I was born in 1981. Okay, I was before this. We were coming up before that girls in STEM was a thing. And I think I really just, I mean, we were around for the math is hard Barbie. I always quote her wrong. If I got it wrong, I know whatever the exact quote Barbie said. But, you know, I think I really internalized that, and I internalized it as subjects that I didn't have any interest in. Even today, I'll still make jokes about, like, I don't do math. I went to law school. And I'm realizing, like, that was really harmful, and it's not necessarily true that I wasn't interested in those subjects or didn't find things that I really liked, but, you know, it just felt easier to lean into the stuff that I was interested in and was sort of a safe topic. Or maybe the idea that I liked politics, which wasn't necessarily a girl-friendly topic, was enough, and I wasn't trying to fight a multi-front battle.
I have a little tip for those of you out there with four-year-olds. Maybe not all four-year-olds, but around that age, because I've been thinking a lot about this and how I wish from an early age I had been pushed more on math and science. I did the same thing, Sarah. I knew it was kind of not a girl's thing. I wasn't in love with it. I didn't have teachers who were as good in math and science as in everything else. So I gravitated away from it too. And I really don't want that to happen with my girls. So with Ellen, I decided last week to do a little exercise about graphs, because I want her to get excited about scientific literacy and translating numbers as pictures. So I made just a really simple grid. And we did an exercise where we called a bunch of our family members and had them FaceTime with us while Ellen rolled dice for them. And then she counted up what they got on the dice, and she made a bar graph showing everybody's rolls of the dice. So she got to say hello to everybody. It was really fun to see all the grandparents. We had a couple different colors of dice, so she could ask them, which color do you want? We talked about, gosh, everybody in our family wants the green dice. How fun is that? And then we saw the graph results, so she learned how a graph works, and we saw that you're more likely to roll a six. And, you know, it was just lots of different concepts embedded in this one really simple thing that she had a ton of fun with and is excited to do again.
Listen, there's all kinds of graph opportunities with sugary treats. We did a Lucky Charms graph on St. Patrick's Day with the different marshmallows.
Fun.
You can also do Skittles graphs. Mm-hmm. Yep, Skittles, M&Ms, any sort of multicolored sugary treat. Endless graph opportunities.
Well, we hope that you are finding lots of good activities out there, whether it be for your own lifelong learning or for the lifelong learning of others. Thank you for making us part of that. We hope that we contribute to your thinking in positive ways. This week, I'm so excited, Sarah. It's Supreme Court week on the Nightly Nuance. In addition to Sarah and me checking in every day on how we're doing with coronavirus and the news developments around it, you can hear little mini podcasts from me about the cases that the court is handing down beginning on Monday, the day that we're recording, with the Clean Water Act. And I hope you'll join us there. Until we're in your ears again on Friday, keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Dylan Garvin and Studio D Productions. Elise Knapp.